Right, I'd like to welcome you here tonight. My name is Penny Tilby, and this forum is on the case for expanding Medicare, and it's sponsored by the Vancouver Burnaby chapter of the Council of Canadians. And as some of you probably know, the Council of Canadians was founded in 1985 and is Canada's largest citizens' organization and has members and chapters all across the country. The Council works to protect Canadian independence by promoting progressive policies on issues like fair trade, clean water, safe food, public health care, and other issues of social and economic concern to Canadians. Medicare is a particular focus for us at present because of the erosion of our public health care system that we're seeing taking place at all levels of government. What we're going to do this evening is make the case that not only can we defend our public system, but we do have the resources and capacity to expand it in a number of significant areas. So on our panel this evening, we have Murray Dobbin, Colleen Fuller, and Mark Lee. And we're going to take them in that order. And after the speakers, we'll then have a question and answer period. So our first speaker is Murray Dobbin. Murray's been a journalist, broadcaster, author, and social activist for over 35 years. I don't know how many over 35, but probably some. He's been a columnist for the Financial Post, the Winnipeg Peg Free Press. He contributes to the Globe and Mail and other Canadian dailies, and he now writes a column for the Vancouver online paper, The Tyee, also for the Georgia Strait on occasion. He's had a long history with the Council of Canadians, and he's currently the chair of our Vancouver Burnaby chapter. He's the author of a number of books, including The Myth of the Good Corporate Citizen, and most recently a book on Paul Martin. Murray's going to talk about the nature of the so-called crisis in Medicare and why we should be thinking of expanding, not just defending what we have. Murray.
In honor of our topic tonight, I put my back out this morning. So if I whinge, it's not for any other reason than that. Over the last 15 years, most meetings like this would be called in defense of Medicare instead of expanding Medicare. And one of the things that I think the people fighting for Medicare in this province have sort of come to the conclusion over the last little while is that we need to change the dialogue on Medicare. We need to change the language. We've been defending it for a long time, and every year they do something else to it and constantly say that it's in crisis. So in order to change that debate, in order to force those who would like to privatize Medicare to actually defend their position, we think it's really important to begin to talk about expanding Medicare rather than simply defending it. So what I want to talk a bit about tonight is the whole sort of history of how governments have actually voluntarily gutted themselves in terms of their capacity to spend money on the things that Canadians say they want. I mean, today, this week is a perfect example. We have a $13 billion surplus, and Stephen Harper announces that we're going to cut $1 billion. Now, we could talk all night about those cuts. Certainly, it's an attack on democracy, which, of course, you would expect from Stephen Harper, attacking the Court Challenges Program, the status of women, the Law Reform Commission, the Center for Research and Information, all of these institutes, which cost very little money but can't exist without the money. All of them contribute to democracy. But I think even worse than the cuts is the fact that they made a big deal and were proud of the fact that they were putting $13 billion to pay down the debt. The debt we already have, compared to other OECD countries, a very low debt to GDP ratio, which is how economists determine these things and look at them. So we do not have an overwhelming debt, but it's a really good way to get rid of excess money if you don't want to spend it on social programs. And all across Canada, we have provincial governments that have done the same thing. We have the phenomenon of anti-governments, governments by parties actually hostile to the very idea of committing themselves to social programs and democracy. We now have the phenomenon of governments who voluntarily got themselves boasting about how small they can make themselves. Sort of like Alice in Wonderland. One pill makes you larger, one pill makes you small, except they threw out all the pills that make them larger. The mantra for the past 10 years has been that we can't afford generous, effective, accessible social programs. This will go down in the history of Canada as the biggest lies of all the lies that governments tell us. A key fact to keep in mind, we are now over twice as wealthy per capita as we were in 1967 when we first brought in Medicare. We are twice as wealthy per capita as we were in 1967. And the notion that we cannot afford Medicare or Medicare is not sustainable is preposterous. But if we look at how this happened, it's fairly simple, even though it's fairly brutal. Our governments have systematically raided the bank accounts for social programs by cutting taxes and cutting revenues to ensure that they don't have the money that we need for the things we want. You remember the deficit hysteria campaigns of the early 1990s when we were all going to hell in a handbasket and Canada was going to go bankrupt and all of the stuff. It was relentless. Literally thousands of articles and news stories talking about the deficit. Now, there's no question that the deficit was a problem. No one would suggest that. It's just that it wasn't the problem. But Paul Martin cynically used the large deficits in the mid-1990s to cut $23 billion from social transfers for Medicare, education, and social assistance. What's really interesting about this, if you ever get a chance to look at the speech he made in the budget in 1995, he did not boast about getting rid of the deficit. He boasted about taking government spending back to the level of 1950 in terms of the percentage we spend of the wealth we have on government. He boasted about it, and he boasted about it in meeting after that budget. But the fact was that he wouldn't have had to cut at all. By 1997, 2 years after he made that budget speech, we actually started having surpluses. And Jim Stanford, an economist with the CAW, calculated that if we had not made a single cut, if we had just stayed at the level of spending of 1995, the deficit would have disappeared 1 year later. So we wouldn't have had to cut any of that $23 billion. In fact, the surpluses were so big, he kept trying to hide them. And the CCPA kept pointing out what the surpluses were going to be, and they were accurate every year, and the government always lowballed, because at the end of the year, the surplus goes to pay down the debt. But by the year 2000, even the mass media, which was surprising to many, had figured this out and were starting to call Paul Martin on this, saying, look, you know, these estimates of your surpluses are deliberately low. So what did he do in the year 2000? He implemented a $100 billion tax cut over 5 years. So what Paul Martin actually had was not a deficit crisis, he had a surplus crisis, because Paul Martin did not want to spend money on social programs and the things that people want. He wanted smaller government. He was proud of the fact he'd taken it back to 1950s spending, and he wanted to keep it that way, and that's why he gave a $100 billion tax cut over 5 years. By the way, it was the most unfair tax cut in Canadian history. 77% of that tax cut, in terms of the personal tax cut, went to the wealthiest 8% of Canadians. Corporate taxes were also slashed over the years from about 29% to 21% under Paul Martin, and they're going down further. I think they're now something like 19%. But between 1984, when the tax cuts really began under Mulroney, and the year 2001, the federal governments have voluntarily given up $250 billion. That's $15 billion a year, less than we would have if none of those tax cuts. We would have had $15 billion more to spend, which means in terms of Medicare, which is what we're talking about tonight, I think it probably would have funded a pharmacare program and a home care program, or at least gone a very long way to doing that. What about the provinces? The provinces are always complaining, well, we don't have enough money, you know, the federal government has surpluses and we're starving and yada yada. They're just as bad. As Mark pointed out in a paper on the fiscal imbalance, you know, and another one of these phrases that are designed to put you to sleep so they don't really listen to what it's about. He pointed out that between 1995 and 2005, the provinces voluntarily reduced their revenue by between $18 and $24 billion. So there's more money given up. But even tax cuts were not enough. Ottawa has had surpluses every year since 1997. And this year we have this enormous budget of $13 billion. Imagine what could be done with that. They could honor the Kelowna Accord, you know, and still have $8 billion left over. During the Martin period, something like 90% of the surpluses ended up going to debt reduction or tax cuts. And of course, Harper now, with this, I mean, the logic behind Harper's move this week was, well, we're cutting, we want to have a leaner government, we've cut $1 billion, but seeing as we have such a big surplus, we'll have to cut taxes even more so we don't have that surplus. So you can see where this goes. The Harper government views the role of government to be very narrow. The armed forces, the RCMP, intelligence, the Bank of Canada, and foreign policy. In his heart of hearts, that's all that Stephen Harper thinks government should be doing. And you could extrapolate from these kinds of cuts and where the surpluses are put, you can imagine that might be all we can do 15 or 20 years from now. Gordon Campbell's the same. Came to power, he had a $1 billion surplus from the previous government. The first thing he did, the very first act of the Campbell government, was to cut $2 billion in taxes. So it creates a useful crisis. In other words, well, all of a sudden we have a deficit. And in fact, a year later, he had a deficit of $4.5 billion, one of the largest in BC history, which gave him the excuse, of course, to cut all kinds of programs. So this pattern, I mean, you could go through almost every province and see the same pattern. So what we are witnessing is a sort of rapid Americanization of Canada by stealth as public goods, that is to say those we create and use ourselves as a community, erode or disappear, and private goods and services increase where we have to spend our own money. And the difference, of course, between public goods and services and private is that public goods and services are universally accessible to everyone regardless of income. And private services are available to those who can pay. It's quite simple. So what drives these governments to voluntarily gut themselves of their own revenues and make sure they don't have enough money? Well, first let me say that they don't downsize everything. The military has had incredible increases. Paul Martin, in spite of the fact that we were seventh of all the NATO countries in absolute dollars in 1995, Paul Martin increased military spending over 5 years by $12.5 billion. One of the first things Harper did was increase it by another $5.3 billion, which will mean that when all these increases come in, we will have a bigger military budget than we did at any time during the Cold War. Now, we're also still spending money on Medicare, many billions of dollars, but let me explain partly why that's still the case. Globally, there are hundreds of billions, possibly trillions of dollars in investment dollars looking for places to invest profitably. The whole production of goods across the world, especially in the developed world, is pretty much maxed out. And in Canada, for example, two-thirds of our economy is now services. Three-quarters of people in Canada who are working work in the services industries, not in the goods industry. So there's this enormous area where capital wants to invest and makes a profit. Now, part of the problem, of course, is that many services, in fact, the largest services, healthcare and education, and municipal services, are all public, or mostly all public. So capital has a problem. They can't make money off public services. So one of the things that corporations globally have been doing is to bend over backwards to crowbar open public services like Medicare and education so that they can break open the piggy bank. It's all about corporate greed. They want to profit off Medicare and education, municipal services, recreation, you name it. So why have people accepted this state of affairs? In my book on corporations, I called it the revolution of lowered expectations. There was a book written, commissioned by an outfit called the Trilateral Commission, which many of you will be familiar with. It's sort of an international boys club of very powerful men, former presidents and prime ministers, CEOs of the largest corporations in the world, academics and others, who get together each year and talk quietly, where they're not heard by others, about where the world economy should go. One of the first books they commissioned was called The Crisis in Democracy. And I quote that one of their conclusions was that there is, quote, an excess of democracy. And what they, in expanding on that, what they meant by an excess of democracy was that people's expectations of what government can do have simply gotten too high. Citizens need a cold shower. We have to lower their expectations, and that's exactly what they've done over the last 20 years. First of all, you had the There Is No Alternative campaign. It was said so many times that it turned into the acronym TINA. In other words, it's this constant repetition of this notion that with globalization we have no alternative. We have to compete globally, we have to cut social programs, we have to tighten our belt, we have to have 23 jobs in each lifetime, all of that stuff. Then, of course, there was deficit hysteria, which was largely a phony campaign, as I said earlier, set up to justify cuts to government spending. And then, there's the slagging of government itself. You know, public employees are underworked, overpaid, lazy, all of the stuff that you read in lots of newspapers across this country, a deliberate attempt to divide citizens from those who provide them with services so that when they're laid off, citizens don't care as much because they say, well, why shouldn't they be laid off? Why should they have a guaranteed job? I'm sure all of you have heard that argument. And then, of course, the tax cuts try to lock all this in, because if you don't have the money, you can't pay for the services. We need a counter-revolution of higher expectations. That's what we need. We can afford what we need and want from government. It's time to quit just defending Medicare, but not just Medicare, other social programs. We have to demand more. Home care, pharma care, dental care. I mean, I'm a bit of a fraud up here because I'm not an expert in the whole area of Medicare, but I do want to just set the context for the discussion that we need to shift our attention and shift how we fight for Medicare. We are a fabulously wealthy country. We have a strong sense of community and are committed to equality. We have the wealth to do it. In a democracy, we get to decide. Thank you.